Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudin. In this hour, how might privatization amount to what our next guest calls a constitutional coup? And first, Los Angeles is embroiled in a city governance crisis due to a leaked audio highlighting racism among elected city council members. It has demonstrated that race is still a fundamental problem in the city. Doug Becker explores race in Los Angeles.
I'm Doug Becker. This month, a leaked audio of anti-Black and other racist statements from LA City Council President Nuri Martinez and two other city council members, Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon, has rocked the city. Martinez has resigned her position on the council, but Cedillo and De Leon remain as of when we're recording on Thursday, October 20th. But perhaps what is the most important result of this leaked audio is the city once again confronting its challenges on race. In particular, racism directed against African Americans from Latinx leaders, as well as inter-Latinx racism, has many of us once again pondering where this city has been and where it's going. This show is based in Los Angeles. Many of you know I teach in downtown LA at the University of Southern California. So we're exploring these extremely important issues from very much inside Los Angeles and what the impact of the scandal has been on the city. Our guest today is Claudia Sandoval. She's assistant professor of political science at Loyola Marymount University here in Los Angeles as well. She's the author of Black, Brown, Young, and Together, Inter and Intra-Group Affinity and Coalitions Between Black and Latino Youth. And with her colleague at Loyola Marymount, Chaya Crowder, has co-authored an opinion article, Latino Leaders Can Collaborate with Black Communities. Why don't they? So, Claudia Sandoval, thank you very much for joining us right here in the middle of all this going on. Considering, you know, our listeners aren't necessarily from Los Angeles and may not have been following the details of what's been going on, could you, first of all, synopsize what's been going on at City Hall?
So over the last 2 weeks, we've been dealing with those of us who are interested in politics or folks who are in politics have been dealing with this leaked audio that showcases from at least a year ago, a conversation between Nuri Martinez, Ron Herrera, Kevin De Leon, and Gil Cedillo, who are all part of city council, except for Ron, who was the president of the Federation of Labor. And in these audios, you hear a conversation that is fundamentally about redistricting and the conversation about how redistricting would look in Los Angeles. But in the middle of that conversation threaded into that conversation was this deeply rooted anti-Black conversation among four powerful Latino leaders. As somebody who thinks about and has studied Black-Latino relations, particularly in the LA context, it was not surprising in the least bit, though still heartbreaking, to hear the remarks that were particularly coming from Nuri Martinez, who was the president of the LA City Council, the first Latina to hold that position. So it was really heartbreaking to hear that, though, again, not really surprising.
And so the question about redistricting raises the issue of representation in city government. I mean, one noted part of Los Angeles is the mayors of LA have been overwhelmingly white. In fact, the only Latino we've had as mayor is Antonio Villaraigosa, correct?
Correct. So, and in order to elect him in the mid-1990s into the 2000s, it required a Black-Latino alliance, right? Political alliance to get him elected. So it's particularly important to talk about Black-Latino relations politically, not just socially, though socially obviously kind of comes into the political. It becomes important, especially for Latino leaders.
And of course, we'll get to the city council in just a moment, but with the mayoral race, the two candidates in the runoff is an African-American woman and a white man, though I will, for the record, he's declared that he's Latin himself because he's Italian. The rest of us aren't buying it. But in any case, to highlight this question about, I mean, you would imagine then the Latino vote is going to be pretty essential in either of those, you know, campaigns to win the mayoral race. Is that the expectation that Latinos are likely to be the ones to elect the mayor?
I don't know if they're the ones likely to elect the mayor, given that, you know, Latinos don't necessarily go out and vote extensively. And you actually see a lot, a much more powerful electoral bloc within the African-American community, which is why having a not just a pandering type of alliance between Blacks and Latinos, but one that is fully committed to growing equality is important. So I think Latinos can be important. Will they be important is another question, because as we've seen, you know, it really depends on will Latinos go out and vote. And for the mayoral race, we also have to remember that Karen Bass was one of the founding members of a Black and Latino community organization, which in, if you're from LA, you've probably heard of it, COCO, right? Right in South LA. She's one of the founding members of one of the most important Black and Latino organizations. So I think it's important, though, she does highlight it quite a bit in her campaigning. I don't know that people pick up on that. And I don't know whether, you know, like how separated she is from the ideals of COCO at this point. But I think Latinos can be important. I just, you know, I wonder if they will go out and vote.
So far, we've been speaking of Latinos as sort of a single block or kind of a single group. I think it's important to note that the Latino population in Los Angeles is incredibly diverse, even within Latin American countries.
Right.
I know, for example, we have a substantial Mexican American population, but also quite a substantial Central American population, that not counting those from South America. Are there divisions within the Latino community that make the idea of Latinos as a kind of a singular group that make that a bit problematic?
Yes and no, right? Mm-hmm. I think there absolutely can. And, you know, they're not just diverse as Latino group. When we think of Latino as being a particular type of racial group, but you can also think about Latinos as being Black, right? And so that Black Latinos exist. And so that kind of adds to the fold of like the relationship that exists between these groups. Is there a cultural strain? Yes, sometimes there is a cultural strain, right? Within communities, there, you know, there's a fundamental difference between being acknowledged as Central American versus being acknowledged as being Mexican and not being confused as one or the other. But there's a racializing component to the way we live in our society, right? In that people don't understand variation and don't function in society through variation. They're very dichotomous. You're either Latino or you're not Latino. You're either Black or you're not Black. And so for many Latinos within the community, there's difference. For outsiders, we're all treated the same. And so sometimes we have to acknowledge that we're treated the same and that what's going to affect you is going to affect me, not because I think we're the same, but because others think we're the same.
Now, I asked this question being, I can't say I'm new to LA. I've been out here for 25 years, but I wasn't born and raised here. And of course, an acknowledgement, I think, you know, anybody who's seen the webpage knows that I'm, you know, I'm white myself and, you know, living in the Valley. My interpretation of what was going on, my gut reaction as somebody that doesn't study LA politics is that the Latino African-American divide, the kind of racist statements that came out of people like Nery Martinez was at least in part a sense of, you know, two groups both fighting for recognition, not necessarily seeing themselves as an alliance, but instead kind of pitted against one another against a predominantly white power structure in LA. How accurate is that? Is it is describing what's going on?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, that's always a part of the conversation when it comes to Black and Latino relations, that, you know, there is the the analogy of the pie, right? And there's only so much of the pie that we as Latinos can take and you as Black residents can take or Black political leaders can take. And so we have to fight for those crumbs, right? That's a very zero-sum understanding of the relationship between the two, right? If you have it, I don't. If I have it, you don't. Yet we also have a history in Los Angeles where there was solidarity between Blacks and Latinos, particularly in the 70s and 80s with the Brown Berets, the Black Panthers, other Asian organizations that were kind of coming together to understand their shared experience as oppressed groups, right? And also understanding how they were different, right? And that their oppression was different. So you do have this moment in time where the groups are coming together. There's a bit of solidarity that's happening in the 1970s and 80s. What we end up seeing is that migration from Latin America in the 80s and into the 90s really, really started to explode, especially in places like Los Angeles, right? And so what was starting to seem like solidarity from groups that were far and few between in some sense started to shift to a much larger growing Latino population, right? And so in the 90s into the 2000s, we start to have conversations of, you know, we're actually not, if you have it, I don't, right? We start getting into conversations of competition, and it has really hurt Latinos and African Americans in these communities to have that conversation lingering over them, because it's not really that all of the time. There is some collaboration between the communities, but at the political level, it sometimes feels, especially if you're a political leader, a Latino political leader, who sees the landscape of politics and says, Latinos aren't being really represented in LA City Council in terms of their proportion of the population. So it starts to read like, I want a piece of that pie for my community, mm-hmm. except for Latinos. And, you know, for Gil Cedillo, Kevin De Leon, Noreen Martinez, if I remember correctly, they don't come from predominant Black and Latino communities. They come from Latino communities or historically Latino communities. And I wonder how much of that plays into their understanding of Black Latino relations. Whereas in Black Latino communities like Inglewood, South LA, those relationships are a little bit more complicated. They're not quite hostile. They're not always friendly, right? But there's an understanding of unity. And that they're living in the same place and that sometimes their lives are affected similarly. And so there's kind of a disjuncture. What are we talking about? Latinos generally, Latinos and Black Latino communities, LA as a, you know, in some ways a very segregated city between Black, Latinos and whites. But ultimately, I do think that regardless of where Latinos are in Los Angeles, there's also this hint of anti-Blackness that stems from an understanding of race in Latin America. Just recently, one of my colleagues here at LMU published a book called Racial Baggage, where she talks about these anti-Black sentiments that aren't necessarily developed in the United States, but they're coming from Latin America. They're coming from Latin America. And then that racial baggage is upheld in some ways by the interactions that they have with African Americans here. And, you know, it works in particular ways, depending, I think, where Latinos end up in the city. One thing that was the most apparent in that anti-Blackness that really is rooted in a Latino culture is when Nuri Martinez made the comment of Mike Bonin's son. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to repeat it because it's so incredibly distasteful. But when she made the comment in reference to his son and dehumanizing him, she made it in Spanish. And that to me was like a real indicator She couldn't have said it in English, because I think that in English, it would have signaled that racial stigma that we have of not being explicitly racist. But somehow saying it in Spanish was neutralizing, because there's an acceptance of that type of language in a lot of Latino households as jokes. We're just saying things off the cuff. It's still very old guard, like old guard racism, even in Latino families. But I think it was really significant. That's one of the things that has really stuck with me, that she said it in Spanish when their entire conversation had really been in English.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing racial politics and the ongoing city council scandal in Los Angeles with Claudia Sandoval of Loyola Marymount University. Now, the piece that you co-authored with Chaya Crowder asks the question, Latino leaders can collaborate with Black communities. Why don't they? So why don't they? Why is there not more collaboration?
What we discussed in the piece was really this lack of understanding systemic racism within the Latino community, structural racism. And so what we looked at to come to this conclusion and to really discuss this further were two important questions that were coming out of the survey that we used. It's a survey from UCLA. And in that survey, they asked the question, when it comes to the treatment of Black people by the police and Latino immigrants by immigration officials, what comes closest to your views? Neither are discriminated against racially. Both are discriminated against racially. Only Blacks or only Latinos are discriminated against racially. And what we found was that Black respondents were more likely to say that both groups were discriminated by the police and immigration officials because of race. Latinos were 10% more likely to believe that neither of those cases by police or immigration officials are discriminated against because of race. So there's this lack of understanding in terms of structural oppression by institutions like the police force, immigration officials, right, towards these communities. The other question that we looked at really looked at whether they believed racial problems were issues about race or just rare isolated moments, right, for groups. And 77% of African Americans disagreed that racial issues were rare isolated cases, while 65% of Latinos disagreed that they were rare and isolated. So Latinos were much more likely to believe than African Americans that those cases are rare and isolated. Mm-hmm. Though 65% is still majority of Latinos disagree or agree that they are, you know, that there is more than just rare and isolated cases, but that discrepancy between Blacks and Latinos holds in a lot of questions that kind of give us an indication of their understanding of structural racism.
So, and so what you're saying is, just to reiterate, what you're saying is African Americans are far more likely to see structural racism and a consistent pattern, where Latinos are much more likely to see them as isolated incidents.
Isolated incidents. And for African Americans, they understand that for both Latinos and African Americans, right? And where Latinos are much more likely to say neither. Even Latinos don't experience that, even with immigration officials. So I think not really having that understanding of structural racism is always going to impede a sense of Latinos' connection to the struggle of justice, to a struggle for equality for both Blacks and Latinos, and see it collectively.
So part of what I think you're describing here is a need for an education, you know, campaign and conversations between the African-American community and the Latino community. Because I think one of the things that struck us looking, you know, examining this in Los Angeles was, at the end of the day, specific incident by three elected officials and this labor leader being caught on tape suddenly became a citywide crisis about race, as opposed to here's three people we should probably get rid of on city council. The idea this is exposing wounds that we thought perhaps had healed or were in the process of healing, but is it reopening the wounds, or is it just simply describing the fact that we really haven't healed anywhere near as much as we thought that we had?
I think it's not reopening the wound. It's simply highlighting that we still have work to do. I think the fact that there is a fight right after the leaked audios came out, you know, you had a city council meeting a few days after, and you do have a number of Latino residents, Latino leaders, Latino indigenous residents and Latino indigenous leaders, because we can't forget that a part of that conversation was anti-indigenous as well towards the Oaxacan community in some of the districts that the officials hold, right, and represent. And you saw them come together with African-American leaders and African-American residents to really fight against that type of language, that type of conversation, that type of acceptance of racism. Because ultimately, Cedillo and De Leon, while they participated in the conversation, they're really being held accountable more or less because they didn't stop it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that we do that too, right? Mm-hmm. That if you are, and Herrera as well, though I won't say they didn't make any comments, they did. And I think that's also why they're not resigning, because they think that what they did isn't so bad. Mm-hmm. But I think it is important that we acknowledge that not stopping racism is just as bad as being the person who is evoking racism, right? And so
I think that's a great point. I think there's a couple of other kind of interesting aspects, because I guess at one level, if De Leon and Cedillo do resign, then the immediate sort of city council crisis seems to be averted, or not averted, but that we move beyond it. Because right now, that's what the focus is on, you know, how can activists compel De Leon and Cedillo to step down? But I do know, for example, that Nuria Martinez was replaced on city council by an Armenian. Mm-hmm. So if this question about representation, and I mean, at one level, it's important, you know, to remember we've been speaking of three communities, the mm-hmm. white community, the Latino, the African-American, but Los Angeles is considerably more diverse than that. Important to mention the, you know, Asian-American, AAPI communities, Armenians, which I suppose we classify as white, but certainly not a traditional white community in the U.S. But with all of that in mind, there seems to be at least a pretty legitimate fear that if these three are compelled to resign from city council, that there's no promise they're going to be replaced by Latinos. And right. So therefore it would be a real erosion of Latino power.
And I think that's why so many people are also angry at this entire situation, right? Because when they were talking about redistricting and essentially disenfranchising Black voters, they were doing it because of this fear that Latinos weren't being represented well enough or fully enough in the city council, right? And so ultimately, in their anti-Blackness and trying to empower Latinos through anti-Blackness, they've essentially cut the power of Latino political leaders in Los Angeles. You know, it's hard to say how much. It's hard to say if people will, you know, see it as a issue between these individuals, or simply say, you know, Black and Latino politics can't come together. I don't think it's going to be that extreme, but they have a lot of work to do with the community to make amends for the hurt that they actually created, for, you know, again, for the communities that are working together and that do acknowledge that, you know, coming together is important, but you have to come into a conversation of anti-racism and anti-Blackness wholeheartedly. It's unfortunate that it came through a leaked audio and a conversation that, you know, they never thought would come out, but that those are exactly the moments where one of them should have said, hey, right, like what are you doing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And for all of us just watching this, observing this, we can't imagine a scenario where Cedillo and De Leon remain on city council. They seem to just be delaying the inevitable. But then when we realize, I mean, that's the obvious next step, but then what next? I know one of the issues is that the California Attorney General, Rob Bonta, is examining the entire redistricting process. And so there could be a possibility that there could be a new round of these of redistricting, which I think is probably essential. But also, that can't be all, you know, as far as addressing this. So I guess, what's next?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think along with that, you know, there's calls for the Mark Ridley Thomas case to kind of come back and say, you know, we took him out of city council without his case coming to a full closure just yet. So there's calls to bring him back to city council, especially because the person who took over was Heather Hutt, who was a part of the conversation within that leaked audio, right? So I think, yes, definitely a conversation of redistricting, a conversation about Mark Ridley Thomas and his seat in District 10, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm hoping that, you know, back to the initial question of voters and the Latino influence, I am hoping that Latinos and other residents, Black residents, white residents, Asian residents, realize how important local politics is. Right. And that they start to notice that, you know, with this conversation showcase, or that this conversation showcase how local politics has the most direct effect on your life. Those are the people who are directly representing you. And so hopefully it has a positive effect on political behavior, and that we see people come out to vote, especially during the elections in the next couple of weeks, so that people's voices are actually being represented. Outside of that, I think Kevin De Leon, Cedillo, I don't think Martinez will ever have a political career again, but they all have a lot of work to do within the communities to make amends.
Now, just to sort of shift gears slightly here, Los Angeles is a bit different than some of the other larger cities. I know, for example, you spent some time in Chicago. We were talking about that, you know, comparing Chicago to New York, et cetera, you know, other cities where you have these coalitions, you know, New York, Chicago, that have been there for an awfully long time. They're for decades and decades, where Los Angeles has such a transitory population. Mm-hmm. So many people in LA were not born here. And the city itself sees a shifting of communities, areas that used to be African-American and now more Latino areas, more African-American, other communities, you know, moving around. Yeah. So with that in mind, first of all, that explains some of the reason why there's a lack of civic engagement in LA. You don't have people living in the same neighborhoods that they grew up in, mm-hmm. but also this creates a kind of vacuum where city council seems to be really disengaged with mm-hmm. the local population. I mean, it strikes me that that may be at the core of a lot of this, is that city council really just seems to not be connected with their communities.
I think, you know, that strikes me as very regional for the LA area, right? I can mm-hmm. see places like Santa Monica, West LA, cities or neighborhoods in LA that seem to represent Los Angeles in the media circuit, right? Where, you know, people think of LA and they think of the bars and the restaurants, and but I feel like that's not necessarily true of these Black and Latino communities. They are they're transitioning in terms of racial composition, but you also see that within those neighborhoods, the Black residents have been there for decades, right? Mm. The Latino residents who were migrants at one point, I mean, they're coming in from the 90s. So their transition into those neighborhoods is a little bit more recent than it was for the Black residents, but they've stayed in those neighborhoods, especially, you know, Boyle Heights, Eagle Rock, these more ethnic enclaves, we'll call them, right? Mm-hmm. I think that those areas are shifting now because of gentrification, but to some extent they would stay there if they could afford to live there, mm-hmm. right? And so they're actually moving out because of the political and economic changes that are happening in the neighborhoods that are displacing them mm-hmm. From their communities. So You know, I see a story of two different LAs when it comes to that question, because the LA that I grew up in Inglewood and these other places, they're changing right now because folks are being pushed out, right? But then there's the other LA where people come and go because these are, you know, hot places for people who are coming from outside to go into within the United States, right? That are popular for people from outside, but that, yeah, they kind of rotate. They're not here for long and then they go somewhere else. But when we're talking about these longstanding Black Latino communities, Black and Latino communities, I don't see those necessarily shifting because people are coming in and out. I see them being displaced from their communities.
No, I think it's a very, you know, very valid point. Sort of, and where I'm going with this is going to be the last point that we address here then is, if city council is disengaged from the communities that they're representing. And what's striking me is, even with the replacement and who's being proposed, you mentioned Mark Ridley Thomas coming back, yeah, Paul Krikorian coming back. These are all very well-known names,
right?
The same people. It seems that one of the ways to address this issue of the city council's representation, responsiveness to the needs of the community, is we may just need a new generation,
yeah,
of leaders. And it just doesn't seem like that's happening in LA, but am I hoping against reason that maybe, well, perhaps in the near future, we'll have some new names?
I think so. So we can't forget that Gil Cedillo was actually voted out of his seat by a new younger Latino progressive who actually saw Gil Cedillo as one of like these old school politicians who weren't really doing anything for the community anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right. I think some of these folks need to be voted out, but I think this particular scandal might be helpful in reminding us that, you know, it's time to rotate, right? Like this idea of the incumbent always coming in and feeling safe in their seat, that needs to change.
Absolutely. And I think that's why redistricting matters so much. And I come from the perspective of watching one of the rare cases of a kind of upstart, more populist candidate, Nithya Raman, who represents me. I'm in four.
Yeah, right.
In fourth district. But in any case, the desire for more of those might revitalize LA. So perhaps the eternal optimist in me saying, through this scandal, could we actually see an improved city?
Okay. I hope so. Yeah.
We will leave it with that. Hopefully, yes. Optimistic with all this. We've been discussing the ongoing city council scandal, the crisis in Los Angeles, racial politics, and the ongoing, you know, continuing wounds, continuing crisis of race in Los Angeles today. Our guest has been Claudia Sandoval, assistant professor of political science at Loyola Marymount University. She is the author of Black, Brown, Young, and Together, Inter and Intra-Group Affinity and Coalitions Between Black and Latino Youth, and with her colleague Chaya Crowder, co-authored an opinion piece, and I encourage you to read it. It's really a very fascinating piece. Latino Leaders Can Collaborate with Black Communities, Why Don't They? Claudia, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, how might privatization undermine safeguards of our constitutional republic? Stay with us. This interview first aired in July 2018. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Privatization of government services has been in place since Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, both who roundly attacked government and civil servants as the enemy. Now, however, the government has become in the service of those who once opposed it.
The process has been part of what John Michels calls a constitutional coup. John Michels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Now, you have recently published a book, Constitutional Coup. Coup's a pretty powerful word.
It is. And in fairness, the title was conceived well before the election of Donald Trump, when I would have put much money on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. Now, obviously, I had time to incorporate what it means for Donald Trump to be the president. But the book is really about the way in which the commercialization of government, the outsourcing of key functions, privatization, all of those features of kind of modern neoliberal government, what you call running government like a business or whatever the kind of tropes are of the moment. It's been bipartisan again since the 80s, essentially undermines essential rule of law values. It undercuts our separation of powers, and it becomes a tool of heightened executive power. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I was concerned about that. I started these projects not only saying, you know, thinking Hillary Clinton was going to win. I started writing these projects in the late 2000s when Barack Obama, president, I have great admiration and was happy to have President Obama lead the country. I was still concerned about these trends. These are trends that are partisan. Bill Clinton was a mover in running government like a business. And so the concerns there are really about essentially how commercialization of government isn't just about fraud and abuse of the kind of fiscal sort, which is largely what we've talked about over the years, whether it's military contracting or prison contracting, but it actually undermines central safeguards of our constitutional republic. And that's why I call it a coup, because it completely transforms the way we do everything from welfare services to environmental law to fighting wars to criminal justice. And of course, this has taken on kind of almost cartoonish characteristics in the Trump era, where it seems like, you know, there's very little distance, as it were, between Trump organization, the business operation, and Trump presidency, whether it's, you know, the various Ivanka endeavors or Kushner's real estate deals or Trump talking about, you know, his winery when questions were asked about the kind of KKK rallies in Charlottesville. And his response was, I have, you know, vineyards there. So this has taken on almost cartoonish perspective. And even in the book, I have kind of an optimistic line, which is when we kind of see our way out of the current moment, it might be an opportunity. There might be kind of a bureaucratic renaissance where we realize that some of the folks who kept this country going were the bureaucrats, and we start investing more heavily in a professional civil service. I'm not sure when we get to that point, but that's, again, the kind of ultimate goal, because the civil service provides a very meaningful and powerful check on political agency heads that often represent 48% of the country.
But that's when people are interested in the truth. So, like, when.
Yes.
So that's a clear distinction between what we have now and what we may have had under previous presidents. I mean, to some degree. I recognize that there's degrees to all of this, that it's not black and white.
That is true. But my theory on why we need to have what I call in the book administrative separation powers is because the concerns that I'm raising under Donald Trump's watch or under George W. Bush's watch are just as important under a Barack Obama's watch. Because if you're really worried that a president who wins with a good win these days is 49-50% of the population, because we're so divided, and if some third candidate runs, that's why no one can get to 50. And all of a sudden, the levers of government shift from the right to the left, and all of a sudden our regulatory policy kind of flips on its head. That's disruptive to everyone. We don't have a parliamentary system where you get, okay, the conservative government's out, the Tory government's out, and now we're going to have a Labor government. Everything's going to change on a dime. We don't have that. For one, it's not our culture. You know, it's not just, forget about our constitution. It's just not our culture to be like that. But secondly, we don't have a fail-safe for that. Because if a Labor government takes the country too far, the government collapses. We have to wait. Yeah. We have to wait sometimes 4 really long, hard years for another crack to change the president, and then therefore to change the direction of ICE or the direction of the Pentagon or anything else. And so my position really, I think, is a position that should appeal to those who believe that the center matters and the center holds. Even though I'm not a centrist politically, I think the center is key to our political culture and to our legal culture.
So let's shift just a bit into the argument that you're making about privatization harming the Constitution, the country. Now, it's clear that once you privatize something, that the democratic control is gone because it's not transparent in the same way that government is supposed to be transparent. People don't really have a say over a private corporation in the way that they do over government that they collectively own. But what about this rule of law argument that you made just now? How does it undermine rule of law?
So privatization is a complicated issue. So one of the concerns principally about privatization is the government turns over some responsibility to the contractors and the contractors just run with it. And that is a concern about abdication of government power. That is central and that's well known. I'm also concerned about a second type of, let's say, reconfiguration of government power, and this is where the rule of law comes into play as well. A lot of times, the political leadership of the agencies doesn't like the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is slow. The bureaucracy is obstinate. The bureaucracy is going to say, well, that doesn't really, I understand that's what the president campaigned on, but it's not really comports with the statutes that were that empower us. It's not consistent with our appropriations. It's not consistent with our best scientific understanding. And there's a lot of frustration, a lot of stickiness. And I celebrate that friction because the friction between the political leadership of agencies and the civil servants in some ways reproduces the friction that we hope to exist between Congress and the president. A lot of friction is at the center of our sense of liberty, our sense of pluralism, because it allows more voices to have a say. It does slow things down. It's maddeningly frustrating. But in the 20th century, legislation, so Congress has taken a backseat to agencies. Rules promulgated by agencies become much more central. Think about, think about the environment. We're working off of statutes that are old. The Food and Drug Administration, we're working off statutes that were progressive era statutes. Ever since then, Congress has kind of taken a backseat and the agencies run with it. So if you now have a political leadership that wants to push, let's say, an FDA agenda in a certain direction, let's say, to make it really hard to get over-the-counter or even prescription birth control, as we've seen in various fights, it makes it really hard to do that. That doesn't necessarily match with the best science. You want the pushback. You want the friction. And the civil servants say, no, boss, I can't do that. That's not consistent with our statutory responsibilities to work through the best kind of scientific evidence, and it's not going to be reasonable, and the courts are going to reject it. And so this goes on. Every president doesn't like the civil service. Obama, Clinton, Truman, Eisenhower, whomever. And privatization has now become a backdoor way to get around the civil servants because the contractors are yes men and women, because the civil servants are tenured. You can say no to your boss and show up the next day and get your paycheck. A contractor who says no to the political leadership too much is going to wind up having his contract canceled. So they're going to be completely compliant. And I say the concern isn't runaway contractors as much as it's super compliant contractors, because we lose that friction, that tension that really is at the core of our constitutional regime. So that's why I think it's a basic rule of law question. Once Congress has given the power to the agencies themselves have to be subject to checks and balances. And those checks and balances, as best conceived, is understood between independent civil servants who are professional scientists, economists, social workers, and the politicos who run the agency. And you want both. You want the political and you want the depth that we talked about before. And you want them to have to kind of work out their compromises in the same way that you hope, and that happened in previous eras, that Congress and the president work out their differences.
In an online conversation, you referred to privatization as a weapon of the bullies.
Okay.
Who are the bullies?
The agency heads.
Okay, so the appointees.
I'm not exactly sure what the context was for that.
Key weapon of the bullies.
So it's those who want to essentially enact their policies without following the procedural and substantive hurdles that our Congress and the courts have put into place to make sure that government remains limited and non-arbitrary. It's a shortcut. It's a way to essentially push out civil servants or to scare them. Because once privatization is pervasive as it is now, you don't actually have to use it anymore. The weapon exists because if you're a group of civil servants who like your jobs, now you can't get fired because of your job, but your job could disappear if they find contractors to do it in your place. So if I'm a civil servant sitting at my desk, am I going to push back in a world in which privatization is so rampant and non-controversial? Or am I going to essentially be that the same compliant actor because I don't want to draw the wrath of a political agency head who is very comfortable and very skilled at privatizing? So I think that's what I meant in that context.
So it's a bit of a chilling effect.
Really. Oh, I think it's a quite profound chilling effect. In my book, I refer to Potemkin civil servants who are basically, it says, oh, look, we have this type of meaningful friction between agency heads and civil servants because on paper, they're still classified as civil servants. And on paper, they still have, you know, plenty of legal responsibility. But they look around them and everyone else has been out, all their friends' jobs have been outsourced. They're not going to actually play that role of a fierce civil servant. And it's gotten even worse today. So even outside the privatization, all this rhetoric that they're disloyal, they're deep staters, whatever you want to say about them. Secretary Zinke gave a speech to a business community basically saying that a third of his agency, the Department of Interior, is disloyal to the flag. So there's all sorts of like whistleblowing with the flag saluting. There's all that, not whistleblowing, dog whistling about flags and disloyalty about that. But we haven't seen rhetoric like that since McCarthy. And so again, if you're a civil servant today, your morale is probably in the gutter. And it's hard, you know, you say, well, why don't they all quit? A lot of them, you know, they're 55 and they have kids in college and they want their pension. It's hard. But we also see people leaving in unprecedented numbers. The State Department, you know, and it's places where people have the most marketable skills elsewhere. You'll see that they'll leave first, of course. So to me, it's a problem, and it's getting worse, at least in the short term.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with UCLA law professor John Michaels about how does privatization amount to a constitutional coup?
You mentioned earlier Reagan, and I know in your book you also talked about Margaret Thatcher and the phrase she used of nanny state.
Yeah.
And how there was this push to maybe reduce government or make an enemy of government, calling it the nanny state, but then a move to then put it in the service of something. What is that?
So Reagan ran for office essentially saying he was going to, you know, cut Washington down to size, and he was going to strip the EPA of its resources and the Department of Education and all these kind of grand ways of basically making government super duper small. Then he gets to Washington, and all these people who said, yeah, yeah, great idea, they all kind of wanted to protect their little basically pots of services. And so they got a lot of pushback. And Reagan wasn't able to cut the EPA. In fact, spending rose under his administration. Certainly military spending rose, but even domestic spending rose, and employment rose. But he wanted to cut taxes. He did cut taxes. So we have this escalating deficit. Military spending's through the roof. He can't control domestic spending. So folks at various kind of conservative think tanks said, hey, why don't you try this other idea? It's not exactly what they're doing in the United Kingdom. Because in the United Kingdom, the government-owned state enterprises. They owned Jaguar. They owned, you know, British Petroleum. Those were all state-owned enterprises. We didn't have that. So when they talk about privatization there or privatization in Latin America, it's selling off the telecom companies. We don't have that here. Those were always in private hands. When we privatized here, they said, okay, we're going to cut out civil servants and we're going to hire contractors who are cheaper, don't have benefits, essentially the same casualization of labor we see throughout the economy. At that point, it was largely it was an ideological tool, but it wasn't with a particular political move to change the substance of government. It was a kind of a cost-cutting measure. And then the Clinton-Gore team ran with it. And what I say in the book, in some ways, you know, Reagan is often seen as the kind of critical figure, but in some ways, the most important figure is Clinton, because Clinton takes the idea that seemed to be a hard right, ideological, anti-government perspective by Ronald Reagan, and mainstreams it, and defangs it. So it's no longer this, you know, hostile to Washington. This is all now smarter government, technocratic government, and basically makes it seem palatable to bipartisan audiences. Then they realize this bureaucracy is really stubborn. And we see more as contracting becomes more and more pushed upwards. So it's no longer low-level jobs, no longer functionary jobs. But now policymakers are being contracted out. This is great because they can kind of match. We can have them follow our orders in a much more, expeditious fashion than civil servants who might say, I see what you're saying there, but that doesn't, you know, again, I'm just going to say the same thing. But maybe it doesn't support what the law requires. Maybe it's not consistent with best scientific evidence. Maybe it's cutting some procedural corners because civil servants don't work on political timetables. They're not, and they shouldn't be thinking about midterm elections. And so they could say, this is actually going to take 2.5 years to be done. And then the politicos say, I know, but we have to run for re-election in 6 months. And that's where these conflicts are produced. And then in the 2000s, it just takes off. And so the debasement and the marginalization of the civil service, again, cuts out this, you know, important legal and political players in our national landscape. And again, you say, civil servants, bureaucrats, I don't see they're mentioned in the Constitution. And I get that. But in the 20th century, we have vast delegations of legislative power, which is supposed to be, if you look at the Constitution, done by the legislature. And now all these responsibilities are being delegated to agencies. Agencies become the critical kind of locus of policymaking, not just at the federal level, but you see the same thing at state level, and you see the same thing in any large municipality. Agencies are the main kind of drivers of public policy today. And so we need to think about that space much more carefully than I think we have in the past. And in doing so, it's important to recognize and kind of and credit the role played by the civil servants, that they're not marginal players, they're not illegitimate players. They're meaningful players that have a role, not the dominant role, but a role in the process. And that's why I think if we're going to extend the rule of law to administrative agencies, then we also have to think about what role the civil servants play. And it's much, much bigger than you would understand from reading the Constitution, which doesn't adequately reflect all the dynamics of our current legal political republic.
So from nanny state to sort of nanny corporation.
Yeah.
So you didn't really talk about the corporate side of this so much just now. How would you incorporate that now for us to understand that?
So my book is much more about the kind of Republican values and smaller Republican values.
Meaning
commitments to rule of law, commitments to checks and balances.
Like the Republic.
The Republic. And Republicanism is different from kind of direct democracy. Our country has democracy, but it's leavened by some counter-majoritarian checks. Of course, being one of the critical ones, being a less than, you know, fully responsive Senate because it only gets elected every 6 years is another one. And to me, the civil service is right up there with it. So the book really is a constitutional argument, and it's a constitutional cultural argument as well. There's a whole other side, which is the kind of corporate kind of coziness and rent seeking and extravagant profits that are essentially secured because there's a lot of money that the federal government has. And when we're in Iraq and Afghanistan and they're throwing the money out, you could be sure that some of the contractors are putting some of it in their back pockets. The reason why the book doesn't focus on that in part is because I think journalists have done such an effective job of detailing it. Now, whether it's moved public policy is a separate question. But to me, that angle of privatization is well documented and well rehearsed. If you watch things like 60 Minutes or you read the New York Times, you have a decent sense that contractors can be really corrupt. What I wanted to do is talk about, hey, even if this corruption were put under wraps, even if we could control the corruption, there's a different problem. And arguably, for my purposes as a constitutional lawyer, a much bigger problem, which is this undermines our rule of law. So the corporate part is incredibly important. But it's in part, it's a story that has been told. And more importantly, it can be a distraction. If all we think about the contractors is being greedy, we forget about how actually compliant they are in order to be so greedy. The best way to be a good contractor is to say yes all the time. So you get more and more contracts. That's the best route to being profitable.
So the other thing that you suggested was that in the Trump era, there may be finally a pushback because he and his team have been so brazen. So what do you think might happen?
Well, so that's the big question. What would happen in, just as importantly, I think, is when, for those with some impatience about, you know, what's going to happen next, and I share that. The question is essentially, what happens? How does the country come back together? And what is the agenda going forward? And I think if we get to that point and there's some kind of catharsis, some kind of, I don't know if it's truth and reconciliation or whether there's prosecutions or we just move on and just kind of forget about it. What is the process in which we kind of shore up the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities that have been exposed? Again, I think the country's strong. I think we've done in large part, a really good job of keeping ourselves together as a nation with an old and very flawed document as our backbone. But there certainly needs to be much more extensive disclosure requirements for financial holdings, much deeper and easier to enforce conflicts of interest laws. And again, I think we need to do much more to shore up to secure a viable, attractive civil service that will get people to go into this job, which is going to be a hard task itself. You know, why would anyone want to go into the civil service today? I get that from my students all the time. Those are hard questions. They're going to take decades probably to fully kind of right this ship, as it were. Again, that wasn't necessarily what happened after Nixon because everyone closed ranks and we got reforms right afterwards.
Well, we had a divided government too.
We had a
media that was not divided, and we had a government that was.
We had a government that was, and we had a Democratic landslide, which helped. But Republicans, I think, were also chagrined at that point. And so they did their job, too. I mean, there were certain things that were, you know, we had congressional overrides of presidential vetoes, which meant you had to have Republican support. We don't get that anymore. So there has to be a political cultural change, a political cultural awakening or recognition before we can get any type of meaningful policy change, because we're going to need to do so through legislation or regulation.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's just been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic.
This interview first aired in July 2018. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Mehika Chechi is our intern. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.